How to turn a first draft into a finished book.
The material can be everywhere and anywhere, unorganized, repetitive, and then we get to the end of that first draft, and then the question is, well, then what? So I developed this method while teaching for several years at Grub Street in Boston, a nonprofit writing center there. And it sort of evolved from my theories of narrative that I studied with my first master's degree. And then at some point, a student came up to me and said, you know, where is the book that tells me how to do all this?
That's Stuart Horvitz. We'll talk with him about his book, Architecture Method for Organizing and Revising Any Manuscript. His book is Blueprint, your bestseller. And then Drew Adamek talks with Rajesh Paramaswaran about his new story collection, I Am an Executioner, Love Stories, and also about the process of writing short stories and longer fiction.
The first story is about a tiger who is in love with his keeper and does not know how to express his love and doesn't quite understand his own power and potential for violence as a tiger. So, you know, that's sort of where the tension in his story comes from. And then the second story is about a man who is impersonating a doctor. He has no medical qualifications, but he thinks that he can pull it off in some way. But, of course, things go very badly for him.
And Drew also reviews a novel by Ismail Kader. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's one of the most frustrating parts of writing, how to structure and organize all the different elements of a book, or even an article, short story, or script. How to get a plot line that holds suspense, or weave together different ideas to make one overarching theme that makes your work an integral whole. In other words, how to construct your writing project as a house that's something both you and the reader will enjoy living in. Stuart Horvitz has written a book designed to help you do just that. He devised his book Architecture Method over his years as an editor, book coach, and ghostwriter. In his new book, Blueprint Your Bestseller, Horvitz creates an approach he says can help any writer of any genre get his manuscript into polished form. Horvitz also consults with writers through the company he founded, Book Architecture. Well, Stuart Horvitz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
When I saw the listing about this book, The Book Architecture Method, my ears perked up right away. I've been struggling with a book for the better part of 10 years, and I'm getting to the point where I'm trying to figure out how to structure the damn thing. So this came along. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your process, yourself, and how you developed this book architecture method, and then we're going to talk a lot about the method itself.
Well, sure. As far as the case of working on something for 10 years, that is something that I hear quite frequently. And the method came from wanting to get a first draft out there, so generating material, and we can talk more about, you know, how to generate a first draft, but it's basically the material can be everywhere and anywhere, unorganized, repetitive, and then we get to the end of that first draft, and then the question is, well, then what? And so I developed this method while teaching for several years at Grub Street in Boston, a nonprofit writing center there. And it sort of evolved from my theories of narrative that I studied with my first master's degree. And then at some point, a student came up to me and said, you know, where is the book that tells me how to do all this? Well, so when the student came to me, I was genuinely surprised that there wasn't one. I went back through all the bookstores, through my favorite writing reference sections, and as it turns out, you know, there isn't a book that tells you how to structure in a way that respects your content. So that is probably the most important thing. You know, it's the book architecture method, but it's not a formula. So sometimes people's bells, you know, go off thinking, I'm going to be telling them, you know, you need to have the hero suffer on page 30 and reach redemption on page 270, and it's not like that. It's a method that springs organically from your material itself.
And you're talking a lot about fiction, but you say in this book, in Blueprint for your bestseller that this can apply to any genre?
Oh, absolutely. I use the method when I was writing this book, which is, you know, prescriptive nonfiction. I even use it when I'm writing blogs. You know, in brief, I generate a very messy first draft. I put it away. I brainstorm my scenes, which in a blog really is the paragraphs. And it's always great when you brainstorm from memory because you get a lot of it. You don't get all of it. The things that you don't remember are usually the things that are not memorable. Then I go through those paragraphs, and I can identify which are the ones that are good enough for now, which we call your good scenes, and the ones that are causing me some anxiety, which we call the bad scenes. And then I can use the method from there to actually, you know, create a blog or to write this nonfiction book. I've used it on memoirs, creative nonfiction of all types.
So, Stuart, I want to ask, for a writer who has a lot of anxiety before they even approach the page, how can having structure or having architecture, this idea of approaching a piece of work with an architecture in mind, how is that helpful, and what is that process like when the difference between just sort of approaching a blank slate and approaching something with the idea that there's going to be architecture to it?
Right. That's a great question. You know, fear of the blank page strikes us all. The book actually has six techniques, if you will, for how to generate material. And one of them is don't try to organize anything. And that's, you know, springs directly from your question. Like, we will get to that. You know, there are other things like finding a neutral audience, or counting your words, which I think is one of the most important. So when I sit down to write a first draft, I literally count every word that I'm writing, even if it's longhand, because you can't know the quality of what you're producing while you're producing it, right? But you need some way to measure things so you feel like you got somewhere. So I go with quantity. You also don't know where things go, so that's why we don't try to organize anything. But, you know, that messy first draft, that repetitive monster of however many words, knowing that you have backup, that you have a method, that you have a way through this material really helps me let go, have fun, listen to what it is that I really want to be writing, as opposed to constantly trying to figure out if it's any good or where it goes. You know, and I say you can't do all that at the same time. You can't simultaneously create and know the value of what you're creating. It's like looking in two directions at once. So, you know, the short answer is that having this method as backup can be very freeing to get that first draft out there.
And you also talk about ways of generating content. I mean, more than, you know, counting your words or just knowing that you're going to have a process to wrangle the whole thing later.
One of the most important things is, you know, making the time. I mean, we're all very busy, right? You know, sometimes when I'm doing a workshop, we'll brainstorm all the reasons why we can't write today or this week, from everything from, you know, there's at least three loads of laundry up there right now to I'm the assistant coach on the softball team. You know, we come up with these lists. We could come up with 100 probably right now between the three of us. You know, we honor a lot of our commitments in life, and when we don't honor our writing commitments, I think sometimes it's how we actually feel about being a writer that's getting in the way, whereas we would go get the oil changed. But one of the other important things, I think, Francesca, is finding a neutral audience. This has really helped me. You know, I think a lot of times when we're writing, in our mind, we have our critics on the one hand who we're trying to avoid subtly or refute, and then we have our cheerleaders on the other hand, you know, the ones who are supportive of us in an effusive and maybe even blind way. But really what we need to find is a neutral audience to write to. You know, someone who doesn't know yet our story. And it's very simple and clean to write to this person. And it could be a teacher, could be someone in your writing group, could be a developmental editor, could be even an image of someone. This neutral audience is someone who says, you know, if it's fiction, I just want to know what happens next. I don't have a lot of expectations about whether you're a good writer, whether this is a good story, whether this is a crowded field, whether you're amazing. Just tell me what happens next. And if it's nonfiction, they're saying, just tell me what I need to know about this. So if you can clear up a lot of these sort of, you know, psychological after effects of writing and just write to someone who might be interested in what you have to say, a lot of times it's easier to hear the voice that's in your head.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit more about this architecture. You've mentioned scenes and themes. You talk about three major elements, scenes, series, and themes. Let's start with scene right away, because I had a little trouble with this, figuring out what exactly is a scene.
Yeah. Well, there are, you know, the book offers a five definitions of scene. A lot of times, we could go back to Aristotle, who said, you know, there's the unity of time, place, and action. So a scene frequently, and, you know, this is all my disclaimers here, frequently happens in the same place, frequently happens at the same time, and frequently happens, you know, regarding one central subject matter. So this is how we begin to sort of distinguish the units of our work from the other units of our work. Another, you know, set of definitions I think is useful is a scene is where something happens. It's pretty straightforward, right? Mm-hmm. And because something happens, something changes. So that's generally enough to say this is a scene. And the reason that we're trying to identify our scenes is not so that we're not trying to write a scene that's, you know, to some academic standard of scene, but it's so we can say, okay, that's a scene, and that's a scene, and that's a scene, and that's a scene. So, you know, once we start making these scenes discrete from each other, it makes it much easier to look into individual ones and say, that's pretty good, that's pretty good, that's the one that's really not working. And that's the one that, you know, is, as I said, causing some anxiety. And that's one that I actually forgot to write. And somehow the process of, you know, we could say atomizing or making these scenes individual from each other helps reveal connections between them, helps show where things are missing, where things are repetitive. And, you know, literally one of the steps in the method is to cut up all of your scenes. So I love to do this. I print this out, you know, print the whole thing out, God bless a tree for it, and cut up every scene apart from each other and lay them all out, either on the floor or on some gigantic table if you can find one. And, you know, then this really is the visual representation that each scene has to be able to stand on its own.
We're talking with Stuart Horvitz about his book, Blueprint Your Bestseller, Organize and Revise Any Manuscript with the Book Architecture Method. I'm trying to put this together with the idea of a foreshadowing of suspense. Let me give you an example. The other day I was reading a book to my 8-year-old granddaughter, and I thought it was a really wonderfully written book. I mean, it was just impressing me with the writing, and it begins with the beginning. Within a couple of paragraphs, it moves all the way to the end, and then it goes back to the middle. And I'd say within the first three pages, I mean, she was at first saying, you know, well, what's happening here? What does this mean? But she was really interested. And I'd say the first chapter was pretty much all foreshadowing. It was telling you about people you didn't even know. It was moving back and forth in time. It was very exciting writing. How would you put it together with this architecture that you talk about, Stuart Horvitz, in your book, Blueprint, Your Bestseller?
Well, that, you know, now we're moving into the concept of series. And series is a word that I have appropriated because I got very frustrated working with plot. Now, plot is a singular word. It's somehow a word that's supposed to describe everything that happens in your book, like all of the important things all at once. But I find it much easier to work with the concept of series. So a series is a series of iterations of a particular thing. It could be a person, first time we see the person, second time we see the person, third time we see the person. During those iterations of that person, that's how they become a character, because we see them at first and we don't really even register them. They just sort of, that plants the seed. The second time we see this person, they may change or something in their character might evolve. In fact, this is how a person becomes a character. Another example is an object. So we might see, you know, the folio in a scene, and it doesn't really mean anything to us, or maybe just lays something in our unconscious. But then the second time we see the folio, it's being stolen. You know, that's the change or the variation in which now it's become an object that captures our attention. And these series can be a variety of things. It can be a location. Maybe, you know, we're in a particular setting and we're introduced to it the first time, but then the second time, you know, things are subtly different or they're very different. Or maybe there's a fire that consumes this wonderful Eden or whatever the case may be. So the reason that I work on with series is because you can chart these individual series much more easily than worrying about the entire plot. And once you get all of these series together individually and figure out how you want those to develop, whether it's you want things to improve or you want things to deteriorate, you know, these are each their own little narrative arc, which, again, I think narrative arcs, it should be plural. There is no necessarily overarching narrative arc. There is no overarching plot. I think this is where people really meet up against the structure. I don't know what the word is. I was going to say, you know, devil, but that might be strong.
And could you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Sure. So a series, I'm taking this book, Blueprint, Your Bestseller, on tour, and we have some very exciting short films that accompany the tour. And in one of them, we have a woman. It's actually action figures done with stop-motion photography, which was probably the most more fun than anything I think I've done in 10 years. But you know, this woman is a writer, and she has a book. And we see this book in a variety of situations. We see her on the train holding it. We see her dropping it and the pages going everywhere. We see her meeting a writing instructor who takes the book from her, and she has to brainstorm her scenes, you know, as the book architecture method. Then we see the book being given back to her as she works back through her second draft. The book then becomes a series. So the more it's repeated, the more we're able to focus on it and say, okay, this book is going to be a subject of, this is going to carry some meaning. And I understand that this is, you know, a somewhat complicated concept, which is why, you know, when I'm presenting in person, I'll show a 30-second commercial where the repetitions and variations of a particular series carry the meaning, or something your 8-year-old grandchild may have grown out of. We go through the book Corduroy, where there's a certain thing that's repeated over and over again, and yet there are subtle variations that help us follow an arc up or down.
That's so interesting. Yeah, so we've talked about scene, you've talked about series. Say a little bit more about theme.
Well, theme, you know, is the one thing that your book is about. And your series and your scenes, going through them can actually help you figure out what that one thing is. It's sometimes closely related to what you set out to do, but the work of writing will change it nonetheless. So a lot of times people will come up with their theme through the book's process, and it's subtly different. It's like at 1 o'clock on the hands of a clock when what they thought they were doing was 12 o'clock, because writing is an exercise in which things change and things develop. But having your book be about one thing is where unity comes from. And I've had people, you know, say, well, what about two things? Can my book be about two things? And the answer is, you know, yes, as long as those two things are about one thing. You know, themes could be something like the standard theme of Chick Lit is, I found myself and my man found me, right? That's, I mean, sounds like a cliche, but themes can be a little cliched. Another writer I was working with, it's not how you fall in life, it's how you pick yourself up. So the importance of a theme is not that it's original. The originality is the clothing that you put on that, right? It's the characters, it's the events, it's the internal dialogue, it's the way you bring it to life. But you need to have that touchstone, that one sentence that you can then take all of those scenes that we cut up earlier and compare it to the theme. For example, I say your book can only be about one thing so often that people say, that's my theme. There's actually an exercise in the book where you put the theme right at the center of an archery target, and then you put your various narrative elements around this archery target. It could be your characters, your series, your events, your places, and you see how close or how far from the theme is this particular element. And you might find some things that aren't even related at all. And then, of course, it's up to the individual writer to say, you know, to try to justify that this should actually be in this book. I'm usually the person who tells writers, you know, this is probably a little short story that's lurking inside your novel, and we need to cut this out. This is sort of one of those kill all your darlings kind of thing. Sometimes we leave things that are tangential or whimsical, but you're really trying to get things close to that center of the archery target, really related to the theme of your book. Because this doesn't have to be the only book you ever write, you know? This is the book that has this particular theme. So let's marshal all of our elements towards that theme, and then we can save something for next time.
Well, you know, what you said is just so helpful, because as you were talking, one of the things I've struggled a lot with is theme, because I think I have two themes. I'm writing kind of a memoir and kind of a history, a story of my father's work in the Dutch underground in World War II as part of a book filled with ambiguities, with good people doing bad things and bad people doing good things. And so that's been the theme. And then the other theme is how I found out about my father, who I barely knew. And as you were just talking, I realized that those themes are really the same, because I had a lot of ambiguous feelings about my father. You know, he was both a very good person and not a very good person, and did some wonderful things and some horrible things. And the same thing for the people in the book, who really, you know, were contemptible in some ways, but were tremendously heroic. So is that the kind of process you're talking about?
That's a great example. And, you know, let's just say that that's your theme, good people doing bad things and bad people doing good things. Right? Let's say that's the theme. So then we want to bring in your scenes and your characters and your locations, and we want to say, does this reflect the theme? So it could be a scene from World War II in Amsterdam, where clearly we have a bad person, a Nazi or what have you, you know, doing something that is good because they're touched in that moment, you know. That could be perfect. We could have a scene with you and your father in which he's a good person because of what he has done then, but he's doing something that's bad. And we could have another scene which is something that's, you know, maybe from your life now, which you feel is related, but when you actually look at it, you know, is this a scene in which somebody good does something bad or somebody bad does something good? Maybe it isn't. And maybe then we can start to cull away some of the material that doesn't actually belong there, so that the reader can get this sense that the narrative is inexorable. You know, it's driving forward. It's unified. And basically, you know, all of these scenes are individual units, and when we get them together in the right order about the same thing, then that unit plus unit plus unit equals unity. And that is, it's really the, you know, that's how you achieve unity. Unity is like, you know, meditation or enlightenment or you know, it's not something that you can achieve. It's not something you can do. It's something that you have to prepare the ground for, and then it comes. So, you know, you can't achieve unity, for example, by being comprehensive. I think a lot of people try to do that. They try to just put everything in there. And that sort of turns out like one of those, you know, tomato sauces that we cook when we're first starting to cook, right, with 17 different ingredients. Like, well, carrots, celery, oregano, let's try this, you know, Cajun spice blend. And now we need some white wine. And now we need some orange juice. It's like, that's not going to make something delicious. We need, instead of comprehensiveness in that way, we need consistency and continuity and coherence between the elements. So we actually just want some really nice vine-ripened tomatoes and, you know, some shavings of Parmesan. So basically a great tomato sauce has 6 ingredients in it.
We're talking with Stuart Horvitz about his book, Blueprint Your Bestseller, Organize and Revise Any Manuscript with the Book Architecture Method. And it's fascinating to read. Really unique, I think, on the market. Drew, did you have some more questions?
The only question and I'm not quite sure this is fully formed, but will you address the idea of free-flowing creativity versus structured work? I mean, there's this sort of idea, particularly with really beginning writers, being one myself, that you're just supposed to sit down and let it flow, and that putting structure on it sort of blocks up the process, and that you're supposed to tap into something. But will you talk about the difference and the need for both of those?
That's a great question. As I say in the book, the method is something to do when you're not writing. But anytime you feel possessed with the urge to write, you should put my book down and write. I think it's getting a balance between those moments when you're either inspired or you're just simply keeping your commitments. You know, today I'm going to sit down at 10 o'clock and I'm going to write 1,000 words, and they don't have to be good ones, and they don't have to be in order, and they don't have to make sense, and they don't have to have punctuation. And then there's a way to take a break from that writing. Maybe you generated 4,000 words this week in 4 writing sessions. You take a break from that and you read about structure, or you start doing some of the exercises in the book in which you reflect on what you've done. So it is a balance between the left brain and the right brain, between material generation and material analysis. I do like to say that intelligent planning is not the enemy of creative genius. And if you go back through history, every writer has had a process of both being inspired, of catching a wave, of having a spontaneous or premeditated outpouring, and then sitting down and really looking in the cold light of day at what they've done and taking the best parts of it and going on from there. I think sometimes we have this prejudice or idea that previous writers were just geniuses and stuff, you know, and they didn't have to do these kinds of things. They didn't have to analyze their own work. They didn't have to cut up their own work. They didn't have to take the best parts and try to improve them while letting go of some of their favorite parts that weren't working. But, you know, everybody has to revise and everybody has to organize.
Stuart Horvitz, your book is Blueprint Your Bestseller, Organize and Revise Any Manuscript with the Book Architecture Method. I highly recommend it to our listeners, and thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This is a great time, and wishing you guys the best of success and all the writers out there. No need to be afraid.
Stuart Horvitz is an award-winning essayist and poet. He's taught writing at Grub Street of Boston and Brown University. His book is Blueprint Your Bestseller, Organize and Revise Any Manuscript with the Book Architecture Method. You can find out more about the method at www.bookarchitecture.com or go to Writer's Voice for a link. Next up, Drew Adamek talks with Rajesh Paramaswaran about his new story collection, I Am an Executioner, Love Stories.
Rajesh Paramaswaran's debut short story collection, I Am an Executioner, Love Stories, is a darkly funny and sometimes harrowing exploration of the power of love. The 9 stories in this collection range from a tiger who discovers the destructive power of love, to an executioner trying to get his new bride to understand his job, to an immigrant woman coping with the death of her husband on Thanksgiving, to an alien father trying to raise a teenage daughter on an alien planet hundreds of years in the future. It's always difficult to say what a short story collection is about because there are so many stories and narratives contained within. But I Am an Executioner is about the most basic concerns that we all share. Richly written with humor and a deep humanity, this collection looks at what it means to love and to be concerned with the frailty of human connection. It is a testament to Paramaswaran's skill as a writer that what his characters experience is relatable and touching for the reader, no matter who or what they are. It is not the characters' differences from the reader, of which there are many that carry this collection, but the commonalities of experience that run through each of these stories. He creates a world in which the reader both sympathizes with animals and killers and aliens, and yet doesn't really notice that they are so much different from the reader. Paramaswaran is a writer of rare skill, blending sadness, hope, despair, love, and power in ways that are both touching and repellent. His stories have appeared in McSweeney's, Granta, and his story, The Strange Career of Dr. Raju Gopalarajan, won the National Magazine Award. I Am an Executioner is his debut collection. I spoke to Rajesh about balancing darkness with humor, finding a voice for unexpected characters, and connecting readers to themselves. So, thank you so much for joining us, Rajesh.
Thank you for having me.
This first question is always the hardest question for me to ask in relation to short story collections, because it's such a broad, difficult question to answer. But for someone for a new reader or someone not familiar with your collection, what is this collection about, or how would you describe what this collection of stories is?
I would say that the collection is very diverse in terms of subject matter, but they're all darkly comic love stories of one sort or another, and they all have to do with love and power in some form or another. Although some of the stories are about animals, some of them are about aliens, some of them are about realistic immigrant families in the suburbs. Even though they're in absurd situations, they're, you know, recognizable human beings. But all of these stories, I wrote them one at a time without really conceiving them as a collection, but I realized in retrospect that there was a very clear theme running through them, which made it a kind of an exciting book, because each of the stories might be about a totally different subject matter, totally different setting, but you see, I think, very clear themes. And I hope they're all funny, but they're all quite dark and sometimes violent. So I think that imprint is on each of the stories.
One of the questions that I have is sort of the chronology of this. And since this is your debut collection, what time frame are we talking about, and how long did it take you to write these stories? And what was your development as a writer over the course of these stories from the beginning to having that collection in your hand?
I think it took around 6 to 10 years, depending on how you want to count it. The oldest story in the book was written 10 years before the book came out. So it was a very slow process, and I'm sure I hope I would have changed as a writer over that time. And I can certainly see the difference in the early stories and then the later stories and the sorts of things that I'm sort of doing and thinking about. But I'm also always surprised to see that the commonalities, you know, sort of the themes that are still cropping up in a story that I wrote 10 years later. It's amazing, you know, as much as you try to escape yourself through fiction, or you might think that's possible, you sort of keep writing the same thing. There's a great Borges parable about a man who tries to make a map of the whole world, or he tries to create a world. I'm going to mangle this, but he's creating this huge map with, you know, imagining these kingdoms and these mountains and these fabulous landscapes, and it takes him his whole life to do it, and then he steps back from it when he's finished, and he sees that he's created a picture of his own face. So I guess that's sort of a great metaphor for a writer's body of work, and it ends up sort of just being about the things that have always preoccupied you, I guess. We'll see how it unfolds.
There was a passage in one of these stories that really struck me as one of the sort of key themes, and I would like to read it if I could, and then just sort of have you comment on it, because the theme that I'm about to, the passage that I'm about to read, really struck me as, in some ways, at the heart of a lot of these stories, and it's from the story, "The Strange Career of Dr. Raja Gopalarajan." This, she thought, was the great ocean of the middle of marriage. The home shore had disappeared from sight, and what had appeared as infinite promise became instead a terrifying endlessness, a lonely, crushing isolation of two selves in the world. And to me, that struggle of two selves in isolation of the world really felt like at the very heart of a lot of these stories and what made them so captivating for me, regardless of their settings or their circumstances. Is that something that you saw as a central theme in these stories, that struggle between two people trying to make a connection?
I think it certainly is. I don't know that I was thinking of that when I was writing these stories, you know, but in retrospect, as you know, and it's there in a sentence, so I can't deny it. But I might have just been thinking, you know, wouldn't this make a great story to write about an executioner who has just gotten married? What would that be like? Or isn't this a cool idea to write about a tiger and his relationship with his zookeeper? And then, I wasn't thinking, oh, and this will be an examination of two isolated selves trying to make a connection. I was not thinking that at all. I was just thinking, well, you know, this is an interesting and rich situation. But then, you know, it is there. All these stories are about relationships and about connection. And I think the isolation of that, you know, that is described in that sentence is probably a bit of a scary thing for the woman that is being described there. And I think the connection between sort of two selves in isolation versus, you know, selves in a group or in a community is also at issue in at least one or two of the stories. Like the story about elephants is about a really complicated, intricate sort of community of, in this case, elephants, and the tension between the individual and the group is at play there. And I think it's sort of a, you know, human connection is really what all fiction is about. Maybe we could find some exceptions, but I can't think of any. But it's also a particular, the idea of the difference, the relationship of the group to the individual is, so it's there in all kinds of fiction, but I think it's a particular immigrant theme, maybe, because there's, you know, I would say, like, there are cultures that are much more group-oriented or family-oriented, and there are cultures that are much more individual-oriented to the individual, and sort of an immigrant in the United States from, say, India might be feeling the tension between those two kinds of worldview acutely. So I think that might be behind some of this as well.
I noticed, as a reader reading through this, several themes, and the first two that I want to touch on are contained in the first two stories. And it feels like there's this sense of unrecognized consequences of one's own power or exerting power without realizing exactly what the consequences are. Was
right.
That something in those first couple of stories that felt genuine to you, or am I misreading that?
No, I think that is certainly there. And it was clearly something that was on my mind as I was writing those stories. I think the first story that you referred to is about a tiger who is in love with his keeper and does not know how to express his love and doesn't quite understand his own power and potential for violence as a tiger. So it carries a lot of, you know, that's sort of where the tension in his story comes from. And then the second story you mentioned is about man who is impersonating a doctor. He has no medical qualifications, but he thinks that he can pull it off in some way. But, of course, things go very badly for him. I was interested. It's just a great, for me, a very interesting dramatic situation. And also just as a unintended consequences are something that, you know, everybody confronts. I don't know. There's sort of a very intriguing theme about, because I don't think any of us really fully understands, you know, five steps down the road, what something we do today might result in. And in terms of structuring a short story, that's a very nice way to do it.
I'm Drew Adamack, and you are listening to Writer's Voice. I am talking to Rajesh Paramaswaran about his new story collection, I Am an Executioner, Love Stories. I want to talk specifically about this second story in the collection, and again, forgive me if I mispronounce something, but it's the strange career of Dr. Raju Gopalarajan.
Gopalarajan.
Sorry, my apologies for the pronunciation. But that to me is one of the best stories in this collection because it
has what you're
talking about, sort of this theme of unintended consequences. Yet it's also about the relationship between this fake doctor and his wife, and it's also darkly funny. But there's a tension in it that as you're reading it, I was really sort of on the edge of my seat, waiting for something terrible to happen, while I was laughing. How do you, as a writer, balance that humor that you mentioned earlier and that darkness?
That's a really good question, and I don't, unfortunately, think I can answer it. I think it's just something sort of really intrinsic to, I would say, my worldview, maybe, or my sensibility as a writer. I don't really know how to describe it, but I couldn't imagine writing a story that was not funny. I just find things... you know, even if they're very sad, the humor sort of is a way of recognizing the sadness and contextualizing the sadness. I don't think it diminishes the awfulness, but it, you know, when you see the difference between how you want things to turn out and how they actually turn out, that difference is just inherently comic, not in a, like a silly or stupid way, but in a, you know, in a sort of a, maybe I would say a profound way. The darkness and the humor are just sort of walk hand in hand in some way, and it's not like, oh, I've written something dark and violent, now I have to follow it up with a joke. It's not calculated in that way. So I hope that's a fuzzy enough answer to give you a broad idea.
Well, no, that's that's perfect, because it leads to my next question. And it follows for a couple of the stories within the collection, but the one most particular that I was curious about is the title story of the book, I am an Executioner.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very, I felt that it was a very dark story, and I reacted to it in a very dark way. But yet there's a humanity in this story. And I talked to George Saunders a couple of weeks ago about trying to balance this intentionality versus letting the story happen. I'm intending to write a dark character or a dark story or a message. And I noticed that in a lot of your stories, that there was this darkness but a real creativity at the same time. How do you balance or approach the difference between intentionality and letting the story flow?
It's sort of a tricky balance, and I haven't listen to the George Saunders interview, but I would love to hear his answer to that question, because I admire his writing a lot, and he's also a very dark and very, very funny and very humane writer. I shouldn't say also, but he is those things, and I would aspire to be those things. So it is, like, when I'm writing the story, I think I'm often asking myself, you know, well, what would happen next if you're a tiger who's in love with your keeper, if you're an executioner who has to go to work in the morning, what is the conversation that you would have with your wife, and then what would happen? So to me, it sort of seems like, you know, I'm following the logic of the characters and I'm not imposing my own will as an author, but I think that's also very false because, you know, I'm the one thinking of those things. You know, I can imagine that it is the character who's sort of coming up with the storyline, and that's how it feels. I feel like I'm letting the story take its own logic and unfold in its own way, and I think that's how I have to think of it. But there is clearly a lot of my own intentionality that is in the background, guiding that, whether consciously or not. So I try to let the story do its own thing, but I recognize that, you know, the story would not exist if not for me. So it's a bit of a false consciousness or sort of suspension of disbelief or sort of inherent in that exercise.
There's a wonderful story in the book that reminds me of my favorite short story, and it references that in the story itself. Will you talk about the four Rajeshas and Bartleby the Scrivener? I'm having a rough pronunciation morning.
It's okay, but yeah, Bartleby is a nicer pronunciation, I think. The story Four Rajeshas is about a clerk in a railroad station in rural South India at the turn of the 20th century. And the clerk is a very quirky guy. The railroad station manager has a lot of time getting him to do what he needs to be doing. And he has a hard time writing. And when he's supposed to be copying letters, he tends to go off and make these bizarre marks on the page that the station manager has no idea what to do with. So it's... Writing the story immediately evoked Bartleby to me, and, you know, it could be that the reading Bartleby even gave me the idea of the story, but I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg. But once the connection was clear in my mind, I just wanted to embrace it, because Bartleby is a story that I read and reread constantly, and it's one of my favorite pieces of fiction. And I thought I wanted to grapple with it through my own fiction, through this story. So there is a reference to Bartleby that one of the characters in the story sort of refers to this character as a Bartleby, even though it's a completely anachronistic or at least sort of culturally kind of incongruous reference. And I think I tried to make that part of the joke of the story, because the story is also about my own inability as a author to imagine something that happened 100 years ago, and there's some back and forth between the author and the characters in the story.
We talked earlier about themes in these stories, and one of the themes that this as an entire collection that really struck me and that I found so compelling was that even though we're talking about a tiger or an immigrant family or aliens several hundred years in the future on a alien planet, all of these stories are really about, or I took away from all of these stories, the basic human struggles that we have. How did you put that in so many of these stories, this sort of humanity? Was it a conscious approach, or was it something that came out of how you were, as you said earlier, your own worldview?
I mean, that's a flattering question. And I just don't think, you know, I could write a story that wasn't about basic, as you termed it, basic human struggles. So, you know, writing about animals was a way to sort of get myself out of familiar situations, and about writing about things that I might have seen or kind of have some direct relationship too, and just to be able to sort of invent things more wildly and have more fun with the writing. But it was not a way to actually escape writing about human struggles or human situations. You know, there are some writers who might think of their task as more escapist, you know, or more just genre for the sake of genre. But that's, you know, just sort of basic to the project is writing about human situations for me.
And speaking of the future, I read that you are now working on a novel. What is the how are you experiencing the short story? First, is that true? And how do you experience writing a short story and writing a novel differently? What's the difference in experience for you?
It has been a I'm sure many writers will tell you who have made this transition, but it is a different experience, and it takes some getting used to and sort of some unlearning of the habits of writing a short story. But then you unlearn, you might realize you've unlearned it too much, and then you have to... The basic struggle initially was just or that the freedom of writing a novel is like, hey, now I can go on, and I don't have to bring things around to a point, and things don't have to be as focused, and I can take digressions, and I can do anything I want, and that's kind of exhilarating. It's a little terrifying, but then at a certain point you realize, wait a second, maybe I've taken too many liberties, and I need to cut back a bit, and sort of relearn some of the maybe preoccupations with structure that you were using in constructing short stories. So the process is still unfolding, but it's been a kind of a fun and interesting back and forth, and. Yeah, it's, you know, as I said, I spent about 10 years writing short stories, and you get into a rhythm, and you learn, you know, you start to feel like you know how to do it, and then you start this new thing, and you realize, like, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing, which is, you know, it's great.
Do you have a sense of when we'll see your novel?
As soon as possible. Hopefully not. It won't take another 10 years. And if my editor is listening, it certainly won't. I'm working hard. Thanks for asking.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure to talk to you and to read this collection. I Am an Executioner, Love Stories.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. Great.
That was Drew Adamack talking with Rajesh Paramaswaran about his new story collection, I Am an Executioner, Love Stories. Next, Drew reviews The Fall of the Stone City by Ismail Kader.
History is a quirky thing. Understanding history is a lot like the parable of the blind man and the elephant. Depending on your vantage point, history can be a victory, a defeat, a holocaust, or a glorious defense of the homeland. And that seems to hold for personal history as well as big-picture social, political, and national histories. The lover you remember so fondly becomes a bitter pill after they marry your best friend. The heroic war protester becomes a traitor to the cause when a secret relationship with the FBI is revealed. The great writer is vilified with the discovery of plagiarism. So how does one go about comprehending a history, both personal and national, that is constantly shifting with the vagaries of time, distance, and circumstance? How can you be certain of what really happened, even in your own life, when how you interpret the past is dependent of where you are standing in the present? Ismail Kader examines this question in his novel, The Fall of the Stone City, with a biting, satirical wit and an aching sadness. Out for the first time in English translation, the novel is a complicated intellectual treat, a bitingly funny satire, and a heartbreaking tragedy all at once. Ismail Kader, an Albanian, is considered one of Europe's best writers, and his work has won the Man Booker Prize, and he has been a Nobel candidate several times. The book opens on the small Albanian town of Gjirokastër in 1943 as it prepares for the Nazi invasion from Greece, after the capitulation of the occupying Italians. Gjirokastër is a provincial, medieval town closed up against its neighbors and isolated by a sense of nationalistic entitlement. The Germans approach the main gates of the walled city and are fired upon by unknown assailants. In retaliation, the Germans prepare a bombing campaign, but just as it begins, a white flag is seen over the town. The Germans stop the bombardment but storm the town and take 100 prisoners, threatening execution if the assailants aren't identified. Just as the Germans are rounding up prisoners, a strange scene unfolds in the town square. One of the town's most prominent citizens, Dr. Garometto, meets with the German commander and invites him home to dinner. It seems as if the German colonel and Dr. Garometto were college roommates and long-lost friends. Over the course of the dinner, which is shrouded in mystery, the Germans slowly release all 100 prisoners, including the town's most prominent Jew. Based on an agreement that no party understands or shares, the Germans agree to let Gjirokastër be left unharmed. And there, Kudera sets up his novel. There are three unknowns that the book sets out to solve. Who waved the white flag? Who fired on the Germans? And what really happened at the dinner at Dr. Garometto's house? And the answers change throughout the book, depending on how and where one ponders them. The book follows Dr. Garometto in the town for 10 years, into the rot of communist rule, to trace the evolving understanding of what happened so many years ago. all of the town's sacred cows fall from grace as Kudera, with a keen satire, skewers the blind institutional certainty and petty jealousies that shape history. Dr. Garametto is first hailed as a hero, but as communist revisionism and paranoia slowly take over, he is turned into a villain and arrested as part of a plot to kill Stalin. It is in the final third of the book, during the interrogation, that Kudera reveals the secrets of that long-ago dinner. Answering the question of what exactly happened at the dinner would ruin the novel, so I will leave it at this. What happens to Dr. Garametto in his past and in his present are shocking and grievous, both unbelievable and unjust. But more than the story of Dr. Garametto, the fall of the Stone City is a parable for the difficulty of reconciling Albania's complicated political and social history. For those interested in untangling history generally, and Balkan history specifically, there can be no more tragic and insightful place to start than the fall of the Stone City.
Drew Adamak reviewing Ismail Kader's The Fall of the Stone City. I'd like to take a minute to ask for your help in supporting our exciting new radio series, The River Runs Through Us. In the series' 6 episodes, Writer's Voice co-host Drew Adamak and I talk to writers, historians, artists, musicians, and scholars to discover the influence of the Connecticut River in times past and how it stands as a powerful symbol for today's challenges. We look at the spiritual currents that have flowed through the river's communities. We look at political movements for justice, like Sojourner Truth's fight against slavery. We explore the economic engine of the river's power as it fueled the fortunes of the river gods, the movers, shakers, and factory owners of western Massachusetts. And we examine the environmental challenges and successes of the river in past and present. Writer's Voice has been on the air for nearly 10 years, bringing listeners the kind of in-depth conversation that's so rare in today's media landscape. In all that time, we've never asked for financial support. But now, we really need your help. That's because we actually have received a grant for our work on the series from Mass Humanities, and we're deeply grateful to them for their support. But the grant comes with a condition. We have to raise some money from the public as well. We're not asking for a lot, but what we are asking for will make a huge difference. By supporting this project, you help us to continue to bring thoughtful conversations about literature, the arts, and the world to radio stations across the country. That means we'll be able to keep on bringing you the kind of radio you love. And we'll share the love with you. When you contribute, you can receive rewards like autographed books from Susan Stinson, Jacqueline Sheehan, and Sabina Murray. So please, go to Kickstarter.com and search on The River Runs Through Us to help us reach our goal. Thank you. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.